attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by the former Labour MP for Worcester from 1997 until 2010, and the Parliamentary Undersecretary of State at the Department for International Development between 2008 and 2010, Michael Foster. Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Hi, yeah, good to be here, Will.
So, to begin with, I'd like to ask, as someone who has been a member of Parliament for previously a member of Parliament for a considerable amount of time, what are your general impressions of this general election campaign so far?
Oh, they're very mixed, I have to be honest. I must admit, I think it is a brave decision, and by that I'm talking sort of yes minister definition of brave, to hold a general election in December. I think it's crazy, personally. Because the weather may well determine the turnout at the election, and we only have to go back 2 years when we were snowed in around that same date in December in 2017. So it would be, you know, a catastrophe for democracy if there was a downpour of snow. And I've looked at my weather app today, and snow is forecast both for Thursday and Friday of next week. So it's not looking promising around turnout. So that's the first observation I make. I think we could have a lower turnout than normal. The second observation really is it's because of the nature of the, you know, when the election is held, it's very difficult for people, campaigners that is, to actually make contact with people. Normally, elections in May or June, you've got long evenings. And as you know, as a campaigner and as you know, a resident, having someone knock the door at 6:30, 7 o'clock at night, it's light, it's hopefully warm, that's not a hardship. It's very difficult to A, get people motivated to knock doors at 7 o'clock at night in the middle of winter, even more difficult to get people to open the doors to talk to you at that time of night. So I think the nature of the campaign is probably less reliant upon those doorstep conversations than it has been in the past. And I'm not sure that's a good thing either, because it's actually quite good for candidates, whatever party they are, to get out and about and meet as many people as they can during the election campaign. So those are two sort of practical type observations. At a more sort of macro level, at looking at the big politics of where the parties are, this election is being dominated by basically two things. One is Brexit, and the second one is the dire showings of the leadership offerings of the two main parties. That seems to be what people are talking about in the campaign.
As someone who has obviously successfully stood for Parliament, how influential do you think the manifestos of the parties are on ensuring that a candidate standing for election is elected?
I doubt very much if more than, I don't know, a couple of thousand people across the whole country will have read cover to cover the manifestos of the main parties. It just doesn't happen. But what those manifestos do is, for people who are engaged in public policy making, they're very important. You know, my current day job, you know, it's really important to look through that manifesto in detail to see where our policy areas have got a mention and what was said. So for NGOs, pressure groups, campaigners, they're vital that you've got a mention in the manifesto, because it's a way of holding those that ultimately get elected, holding them to account for what they promised in their manifesto. It gives you a bit of leverage, which is, you know, that's the good side of the manifesto. The downside is they're so big that Joe Public doesn't really take into account the detail of the manifesto. It's more, what do the headlines say? What are the big issues? and what is the feel around the ability of the party to actually deliver upon what was promised in the manifesto. So you can make fantastic promises, but if you've got no chance of actually delivering it in government, then frankly people aren't going to vote for you, in the same way as if you had a totally unpopular manifesto, people aren't going to vote for you either. So you, when you write your manifesto, you've got to get the balance right between what's deliverable, what's realistic, but also what is, you know, what is positive and what is what gives people hope and gives them cause to vote for you in the first place.
Now, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago about the unpopularity of the two main candidates for Prime Minister. This was perhaps obviously quite different when you were first elected in 1997. Do you think that the individual personality and the character of the leader of one of the main parties is crucial, perhaps above all else, to ensuring that that party is elected?
I'm convinced of it. For the vast majority of votes cast, not all of them, but for the vast majority of votes cast, they're cast on the basis of party loyalty, party affinity that people have historically. And there'll be people who will always vote Conservative, full stop. People will always vote Labour or Lib Dem or whatever, full stop. You're not going to influence those. But then the next tranche of people are going to be those that look at the particular leaders. And where there's a popular leader, let's say, you know, Tony Blair at the 1997 election, incredibly popular. And the feel for the Labour Party and the way in which Tony Blair was viewed in such a positive light was far more important in getting me elected than whatever qualities I may or may not have had. I mean, let's be realistic. It's at the national picture that the vast majority of votes are cast. Sure, there are going to be some individuals who you meet as a candidate on the campaign trail that might like what you have said personally about a local issue. They might know you. They might be a neighbour. You will get some votes that way, but the vast majority are going to be on the basis of the party nationally and the leader. And that's why in this particular general election, there are so many questions being asked by people who participate in the process. They're voters, but frankly, they don't know who to vote for this time. And that's, I think, because of the leaders of the two major parties are, you know, they're many ways diametrically opposed to each other, but equally both have got considerable flaws to their character, and that's what's giving people cause for concern.
I'd now like to move on and just touch upon, to begin with, the Conservatives' manifesto. And it was interesting, as I was looking at the manifesto today, Brexit is mentioned 61 times in the manifesto. The phrase "get Brexit done" is mentioned 23 times, but for example, knife crime is only mentioned once. Obesity is only mentioned twice. And I think the environment itself is only mentioned 22 times. Do you think that this demonstrates that the Conservatives, when they say that, oh, once we've got Brexit done, we've got plans to vastly improve the country and all this sort of thing, do you think that proves that in reality they haven't thought about what they're going to do after Brexit and haven't really planned for what they would do as a government after that?
I think it's more to do with the fact that they see Brexit as the defining issue at this election. And certainly the opinion polls suggest that prior loyalties to a political party seem to have disappeared whilst there is this uncertainty around the UK's position with regard to the EU. So Brexit has redefined where your loyalties lie for this election. Whether it's long-term or not, I've genuinely no idea. But certainly it seems to be defining how you vote. And the Conservatives have taken the decision that 52% of the population voted Leave. We haven't left, so But arguably, a large proportion of that block of voters are going to be wanting a resolution. So hence their let's get Brexit done argument. Whereas for the Remainers, and I'll declare now, I'm a staunch Remainer, but for the Remainers, first of all, you've got, you know, more than one party to vote for. So that's split loyalty as to who you vote for as a Remainer. Means that actually, if you're a conservative strategist, you just go, right, just keep it simple. Just say you're going to get Brexit done. Because you're appealing, A, to the bigger bloc, you know, those that won the referendum. And there is certainly, I think, a sentiment out there, whichever way you voted in the referendum in 2016, people are just fed up with this Brexit. They just want it over and done with. So you're tapping into that mindset. You may have even been a Remainer, but you're so sick of the delay and the prevarication within Parliament because there's that lack of understanding of what Parliament's trying to do, that actually you say, yeah, let's get it done, and then we can concentrate on all the other things. Of course, the reality is this election won't get Brexit done if the Conservatives are re-elected to form a government. Because you might get the transition agreement through by January 2020, but then you've got the whole process of negotiating the actual Brexit is still to be done. Mm. So it's a false promise in the manifesto, but there is a degree of appeal there to a certain core block of voters. That said, Will, I have to say, I looked at the Conservative manifesto, and there's some very clever bits in it, from a political campaigner's perspective. That is, I'm not saying I support the manifesto. Just look at it from as a campaigning tool. There's focus on different candidates from different constituencies, and clearly, if you look at it, clearly trying to show what a wide and varied background Conservative candidates are from, which I think is quite clever. But also dotted in, there are specific mentions of local campaigning activities. I'll give an example. Back where, near to where my parents live, up in the Black Country, one of the candidates or one of the pledges is to look at reopening Willenhall train station. Now, Willenhall hasn't had a train station since the 1960s, but the Tory MP in that area has been campaigning for it. So to get it included in the manifesto helps that particular candidate in their re-election campaign, because they can say it's in the manifesto, there's a mention of it, which is, as I said at the beginning, that's what you want to see in a manifesto, something you can point to extract leverage over for the next 5 years. So I think the Conservative manifesto is clever in that it's not particularly detailed. There's not a lot in it. All of the things that you've highlighted, quite rightly, bread and butter issues, don't really get a mention compared to let's get it done, which is the stock message that every well-crafted Conservative spokesperson is parroting at the moment.
It's interesting that you mention the candidates, because there was one particular candidate picture that quite interested me, and it was the picture that they used for Adam Wordsworth, who is the Conservative candidate in Wether Vale, and has the caption, he's a former police officer, but shows him in uniform as a police officer. Now, I mean, regardless of whether you think that's an appropriate thing to do or not, I do think that, as you say, it's quite a clever tactic to demonstrate that the Conservative candidates come from such a wide background, and also perhaps implying that, you know, oh, we are on the side of the police and the police are on the side of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what it's done for deliberate for that reason. So you've got farmers, you've got midwives, people in the health service, former police officers. Yeah, that's what you want to do as a political party. Is show how broad your appeal is, but in particular, you want police officers in effect endorsing you as a political party. Certainly, as a I put my hand up as a candidate when I've produced leaflets as an MP and as a candidate. I've included photographs of police officers in them, where obviously it's been appropriate and they've given permission, etc., 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 because that's a subliminal message that goes out to the electorate. And it's, you know, it's what has gone on probably for time immemorial. That's the type of messaging that's gone on.
As we mentioned, the bread and butter issues, and the main subject being get Brexit done, there has also been a bit of kerfuffle in the manifesto over the promise of 50,000 new nurses, but then there's the whole retaining 18,500, so 18,500 of them wouldn't be new. Do you think that because the overall message is, you know, get Brexit done, that these sort of like nuances as to the fact that the 50,000 nurses won't be new, 18,000 of them will be retained, do you think that because the overall message is so prominent, discrepancies like that are just not getting out to the general public as much as they might do in another manifesto?
I think this is where we see that times have changed, frankly. I think in previous manifestos, those sort of details were very important. Mm. And message discipline, whatever the party, you know, is, that's not relevant, but message discipline across the board was important. So you could not, certainly as a candidate in 1997, running up to the general election, I was not in a position to make promises that I could not absolutely guarantee delivery. And that 1997 manifesto that, you know, Labour was so successful on was actually, it was quite limited in its ambition. Mm. In fact, the argument that we had at the time, it's better to over-deliver and under-promise than over-promise and under-deliver. Mm. So we had, you know, a relatively unambitious manifesto, but actually we did more than that when we were in office. The manifestos across the piece at the moment seem to be, you know, so huge in terms of their ambition that actually when you've had the experience of government, you look and go, well that's just not going to happen. Mm. Let's just not kid ourselves. It's not deliverable. And the bit, I must admit, I have a bit of a hobby horse. I used to teach stats at Worcester, the old Worcester College of Technology. So I've got a bit of a beef about the misuse of statistics. Mm. And the 50,000 nurse, extra nurses promise is an exact reason why statisticians pull their hair out at politicians, because it's not 50,000 new nurses. There might be 50,000 more nurses than there would have been otherwise. Mm. But that's not a particularly catchy phrase to use. And you know, I have to be honest, in, you know, when the coalition government, you know, they were as guilty as anybody of making these sort of promises. I remember one, because because of the area of work I'm in at the moment, where they said energy bills will be £300 lower than they would have been otherwise. Well, no, they've gone up. But you can't say, well, they're lower than they would have been had this, that, and the other happened. Because anybody could say that. The 50,000, I mean, look, they've come unstuck on that number. Does it matter? It should do. In reality, no, it won't. Because I don't think the public, I think they've been bombarded with these promises by all of the parties, that I just think they're so sceptical about any promise they're made, because there are so many of the promises, and they've just become accustomed to politicians not delivering. Mm. And it's a bit of a myth. I think there was a study this week that said, when looking at manifestos in the UK, it was over 80% of promises were actually delivered. Mm. And I remember my time in government, very much that if there was a manifesto commitment, you would go along and tick it to see whether it was still outstanding or not. And there was real, you know, emphasis on delivery, particularly in that first term of a Labour government. with that we had five key pledges, and some of them, they might have appeared unambitious, but they were actually really difficult to do in government. And a lot of resource went into actually delivering it, so that when we faced the electorate in 2001, we could hand on heart say, this is what we promised, and we delivered it, now let us deliver some more. Mm. Genuinely, you know, this election, there is no way some of these commitments are ever going to be met in a five-year term of office. It's just impossible.
And I think that's something that the IFS has raised about both the Conservative and Labour manifestos. And I'd like to turn to Labour's manifesto at the moment. There's a lot of great deal of broad commitments to nationalising Royal Mail, making broadband free, nationalising water, electricity, etc. Do you think that, because in some ways the idea of nationalisation, etc., was rolled out in 2017, do you think that the public are not as engaged with Labour's manifesto this time because it's a sense of, oh, well, we've already heard this and perhaps we didn't like it?
It's interesting. The Labour manifesto and some of the bigger policy offers that have been made seem, according to polling anyway, seem to be viewed fairly positively. Mm. So I think there is an appetite out there for intervention in economic matters that there wasn't 20 years ago. So I think, you know, that would be my take. I think there's genuine interest amongst the public at large because they see an unfairness in society that needs to be addressed, and this is a way in which that unfairness can be dealt with. This is how the message is being put over. So, you know, running the water companies and the energy companies for the national good sounds a really, you know, positive prospect. You go, oh, yeah, we'll have that. Thank you very much. If you just twisted it a bit, as I know some of the polling has been done, and say, do you want state-run broadband? People go, oh, blow me, no, because the state couldn't organise anything. And you know, do you want it run from Whitehall? Oh, no, thank you. I don't want civil servants running the broadband or your energy system. Mm. And that's the difficulty. People have got, in effect, a view of that they know something's wrong. And at the moment, this is the only offer that's being made to do something about it. Mm. Actually, you know, if you were to you know, look at sort of a more sort of social democratic argument, it would be, yeah, we accept there's something wrong, but you don't have to own all of the assets to put it right. Mm. You just manage it better. You just have better regulation. You don't need to own the asset to regulate it, because that's not what makes a system, be it a train operator or an energy company, work in favour of the consumer. It's how you control it. So I did smile this week when I saw one of the left-wing bloggers complaining about the service that he had received on one of the transport operators, LNER. Mm. LNER is state-owned. It's state-run. In effect, it's a nationalised train operator. And still the service was poor because of bad management. Mm. And fundamentally, that's what you have to grapple with. And yes, that needs resource. It needs good managers. It needs to be well-resourced. It might need more taxes to pay for. All of those things are a given. And there might be an argument ethically about the need to intervene in the sort of economic circumstances that we find ourselves in now compared to where we were 20 years ago. But there are some that argue, but owning the asset is just going to make matters worse, not better. Hmm.
Do you think that in part this perhaps desire to support things being run properly and perhaps maybe not run by the state, but engaging with nationalisation in a way that we haven't seen for a long time. It's partly a reaction to a sense that the government at the moment aren't holding responsibility for actually running things. You know, we've seen the government over the past 9 years send out security rather than allowing the police, for example, to police the Olympic Games. They handed out a contract to G4S and then they had to get the police in because they weren't handling it particularly well at the time. And similarly with academy chains, where academy chains have been handed out and then the schools have not been run properly and we've had to see the state intervene again. Do you think this is a reaction against a lack of conservative responsibility, and that's what's driving it, perhaps more than a desire for nationalisation?
It's a good question. I genuinely am uncertain on that front, because for every case that you could mention of an academy school chain that hadn't succeeded, the supporters of academy chains would point to successful academies that have turned around failing schools that were under, quote, state ownership or local authority control. So I've always, you know, for a long time, believed that actually it's not who owns it, it's how it's run that matters. You can have fantastic schools in local authority run structures, brilliant schools. You can have brilliant private sector schools. You know, academy chains can be fantastic, but you can also have dire schools in both. And it's, again, it come back to that point. It's not necessarily the ownership; it's the leadership. So you go into any school, and what determines how well a school does is usually the direction of travel set by the head teacher and the leadership team, and delivered by the staff in the school. And that is true of, you know, it could be a company that provides train operator services. It could be a company that provides your water. I mean, there are some water companies that are not for profit, but they're still going to be nationalised. Well, you know, what's the point of that? You know, why would you nationalise a company that is dedicated and set up as a not for profit enterprise? Surely that's a good thing if you believe in that sort of state regulation and state ownership. You don't want profits being made and payments to dividends to shareholders. That's the argument that's always put out there. But a not-for-profit does all of that. But it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be state-owned and not-for-profit.
I'd just like to now briefly touch upon the Lib Dem manifesto. And one of the, aside from revoking Article 50, one of the policies in the manifesto that has caught quite a few people's attention is the Lib Dem skills wallet, which is they suggest if they form the government or in some part of the government that they would hand out certain amounts of money to provide for adult education at different stages of people's lives. How effective do you think this would be as a policy?
I think as an ambition, it's worthy. I think there's a lot of merit in actually saying to workers, look, you're not going to be doing the same job for the rest of your life. You know, that our economy doesn't operate that way. There will be times when you need to reskill and upskill. And so we are going to equip you all with the resource to enable you to do that. I think that's a very powerful message. It deals with the productivity gap that we have in the UK. And actually, it should be one that raises ambition amongst all of the workforce along the lines of the sort of lifelong learning agenda that, ironically, Labour championed back in the late 1990s. The experience of the Labour government, we tried something very similar with something known as individual learning accounts, which for some worked incredibly well, but unfortunately, there were people who abused the system. And there was a degree of fraud that was committed, and the scheme fell apart as a result of people abusing the system, and so that's my sort of question mark over the skills wallet. I like the idea. I think it's the right thing to try and address. But I'm, you know, again, it's always those harsh lessons that you learn in government that come back to haunt you. Let's suggest you've got to make sure this is done properly. You've got to have it sufficiently flexible to reach everybody that you want to reach, but you can't have the system so flexible that it can be abused. Hmm. So it's the, for me, the question is about the practicality, but that ambition of approaching the sort of 50% of the school population that don't go on to university, I actually think is probably more pressing than arguing for free tuition fees. I think the need is far more pressing amongst that group of individuals than it is for students at university to have free tuition.
Well, we're coming up to the end of the podcast. It's been great to have you on, Michael. It's been a fantastic discussion. Thanks once again for coming on. And I'd just like to ask you one final question. We're coming up towards Christmas. We're into December now, so I would like to ask you, what would you like for Christmas?
Well, that's a good question. It's a question my kids ask me as well. and so I can reply to them quite easily. Actually, in a political world, what would I like for Christmas? I'd like to see a Labour government for Christmas. Absolutely. Would it be a Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn? Probably not, no. But I'd like to see a good Labour government.
Well, I think that's something that I can certainly agree with, and I think quite a few of our listeners will agree with too. Thank you again for coming on the podcast, Michael.
Pleasure, no problem at all.
If you would like to listen to the podcast, you can do so on iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker and YouTube. You can follow us on Twitter at Debated Podcast, like us on Facebook at Debated Podcast. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and I hope you listen to the next one.